Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 364. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. I know you must be thinking there's nothing else going on in the world other than these conventions. It was the Republicans last week right here in Cleveland, and this week it's all going down in Philadelphia with the Democrats. But lest you forget, hey, the Olympics are coming up in just a few. And this week's guest is here to talk all about all things Olympics. Let me introduce him to you. Charlie Walters is the founder and CEO of CW3 Public Relations. He has run campaigns for so many high-profile entertainment and sports clients, ranging from U.S. Olympic team sponsors to the legendary Doris Day. I just like even saying those two words on this show. He is an avid fan of the Olympic Games, and he has attended just a flippin' ton of Olympics in a variety of contexts, including working as a correspondent from the London and Sochi Games for Entertainment Tonight. Here to talk about all things Olympics, Charlie, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hey, Ken. Wow, I'm giving you an immediate gold medal just for that intro. It was amazing. Thank you.
I would like to play the anthem, and we'll just fade to black, and that's it, Charlie. We're done. Good job.
That works for me.
Well, we have so much ground to cover, sir. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. Let's shoot.
Now, talk to me about where this Olympics passion came from. When you were growing up, running around, were you all about, hey, I have to just sit down and watch the Olympics at every opportunity?
Yeah, I really was, to be honest. My parents would be the first to tell you that story. I grew up in a very sports-loving home. I'm the son of a former Major League Baseball player turned sports columnist for the St. Paul, Minnesota Pioneer Press. So I was encouraged at a very young age to not only play sports, but to watch them and pay attention to them. And the Olympics just happened to be the thing that I got really hooked on. I remember being 6 years old when the Los Angeles Games from '84 were on TV, and apparently they couldn't pull me away from the TV. And I got a little Apple IIe computer game where you could act like all the different nations and all the different athletes. And in '88, when they introduced that triple cast cable thing, I made my family get that so that I could watch Olympics 24 hours a day. And I've just been obsessed ever since then. So, yes, it did start at a very young age and culminated with my first Olympics I was able to attend, which was in Sydney in 2000 when I was studying abroad there.
Oh, incredible.
During
incredible.
College, yep.
What was that defining Olympic memory for you growing up? What was that one thing that you still are talking about?
Good question. I think for me, it was the opening ceremony. I just remember somehow knowing even at a young age that this was a big deal, that all of these nations were coming together, especially in a fairly heated time for our country with a few other nations. And I just recognized this being a big deal. So that was kind of the pageantry, I guess, and the hype and everything that went along with that ceremony. I was just kind of obsessed with that concept. And then I remember watching athletes like certainly Greg Louganis in that Olympics. He was a big role model for me, just watching him. I don't know, even at a young age, I think I felt a connection to him. And watching him in the next couple Olympics was probably the defining moment for me. And now, it's great timing. I just came from Greg's big pre-ESPYs event an hour ago, where he was revealing for the press his big, larger-than-life Wheaties box that took him 30 years to get. So I feel like it's kind of come full circle for me. I'm honored that I even know him, much less get to do some work with him.
So incredible. Now, unless we are getting some sort of kickback that I don't know about, but I'm open to it, this is not your therapy session, but if you were to lay down on the couch and tell our listeners, you know, what is it about the Olympics that specifically appeals to you? Why do you think you're so drawn to this content?
Yeah, great question. I think for me, it's a few different things. I think one, you know, like I said, growing up in a sports loving world, it just kind of was what I knew at a young age. I did enjoy sports. I wasn't one of those kids who felt like I was forced to play and, you know, wanted to be off the field. I actually really genuinely liked them, and I played year-round sports all throughout high school, and then a couple things even into college. So So that's part of it, was wanting to be an Olympian. I mean, I think I had this goal from a young age to do all of the things and not just focus on one of them. And maybe that was my problem. I wanted to do so many things that I wasn't disciplined enough in one sport. But at any rate, as many of us find out as we grow up, you know, some of us are built to be Olympians and some of us aren't. And I think at a certain age, I had this list that I would dwindle down to, okay, what are the sports that I could still possibly make it for if I if I qualified today? And eventually, as you get into your early 30s, that list suddenly comes down to maybe some things like luge and bobsled and whatnot. But and even those things, then when you meet those athletes, you're like, nope, I couldn't even do what they do. So at some point in life, I think I decided to transition over to being a gold medal spectator instead of an athlete. But for me, it's just all about the energy. I attend a lot of different world events in the entertainment industry, and for me, the Olympics is just the pinnacle of existence for us. I think, as utopic as it might sound, it's to me the closest that we come to world peace, and seeing all these different, really different types of people and different types of athletes coming together in what I still really consider very healthy competition is to me as good as it gets. I just love working with athletes and love being surrounded by them, and they're as inspiring as it gets for me.
I'm not ruling out, Charlie, you and I training to do the ribbon thing and the rhythmic gymnastics. I think that's still
okay,
in it for us.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, all right.
I've tried throughout the years. I think I've tried almost every single one of the sports by now, and that was one of the ones that I actually felt like I sort of could do. So I'm totally down if you want to enter as the first guy pair in that sport.
Major news breaking right here on this show is so gay. And by the way, I want to remind our not at all stereotypical gay listeners, there are more sports in the Summer Olympics than gymnastics. There are more sports in the Winter Olympics than ice skating. There's a lot of sports out there, Charlie.
Yes, there certainly are. And I make an effort to try to go to as many of them as I can. You know, I found a great culture and following around sports like curling, who's huge in Vancouver, something that Americans don't necessarily pay attention to. And then even things like, you know, ping pong at the Summer Games. I mean, I really try to go to some of those things as well. The athletes are just as amazing, and I wish that media would pay even more attention to them. And sometimes I am given the small little chance to give them some voice and visibility too. So, yeah, if you ever go to Olympics, my advice for people is try to check out some things other than just those stereotyped, well-covered sports, yeah.
What is the vibe like? Is it fair to say, is there some sort of consistent vibe from Olympics to Olympics? Obviously, there's, you know, with different countries, there's going to be different elements of each Olympics, and certainly depending on if they're summer or winter. But is there some sort of consistent narrative thread as someone who has been to so many different Olympics that you can feel in the air?
Yeah. I would say certainly celebratory is the first word that comes to mind. People celebrating one another and elevating one another too. That's one thing I think is so cool when I see, you know, I've worked a lot in the entertainment industry too, and sometimes when you see somebody win an Oscar over another person, it's not quite the same reaction as when somebody wins a medal next to one of their colleagues or comrades. So that's the number one thing I can think of is just a lot of people celebrating not only the sports but just kind of like humanity in general. And the cultural aspect of the Olympics is huge. I think that's something that doesn't necessarily come across on TV. You know, aside from the sports, there's all these great music events and arts festivals and all these things that take place on the ground. And that, to me, is a really big part of it as well. It's just kind of, you know, as many things as you can, as many contexts as you can bring people together from all over the world.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk all about the Rio Olympics in just a second, but can we turn real quick to the Sochi Games? You were there. We certainly talked quite a bit about those Olympics on this show. Our great friend Chadwick Moore from The Advocate did a great piece on being gay in Russia. I would imagine that you had some friends and family who said, Charlie, maybe skip this one?
Yeah, almost all of them, in fact. It was an interesting time because I don't know. I never felt really scared to go there, but I did. Every single person in probably the month leading up to the games, and this is happening a little bit for Rio too, would say like, are you crazy? I can't believe you're going, especially given everything that's going on there. I actually found Sochi to be honest, be one of my favorite Olympics. And part of it was because I was given an opportunity to do a lot more there and have a lot more access to some of the athletes and the sponsors than I might otherwise have had, because a lot of people dropped out. It was kind of the unfortunate thing that occurred there. And I have to say, I was very cognizant of all the politics and all the things going on in outer Russia. And I was very careful. But when I arrived there, I tell the story a lot, within maybe a few hours of being in Sochi, I met some guys who invited me to a gay bar, which is something that I don't think that any of us realized even existed in Sochi. And there was this amazing Olympic-themed drag show that was happening. And I kind of couldn't believe that based on all of the stuff I had read in the media and many of us had read. So I tried to tell a little bit of the story that, you know, as much as we were covering the horrible things that were going on in the government and the message that Putin was sending out about LGBT people not being welcome at the Olympics, there was this whole community of people there that were actually quite welcoming to me. And I wanted to make sure that they kind of got some credit, too, because they weren't necessarily, you know, subscribing to the ideals of the country. And I didn't necessarily feel like they were living in fear. So that was in Sochi. I know that that was not necessarily the case in many other parts of the country. Greg Louganis had a very different experience than me. He went there to Moscow to be a part of what they were trying to call the Out Games, which was, you know, kind of a grassroots movement, which was really brave of them to put on. And he did not have a great experience. They experienced everything from slurs to things being thrown at them to all that sort of stuff. So I guess I felt lucky in the kind of Olympic bubble that we were living in, but I never once felt unsafe because of the person that I was there.
All right. All right, well, let's turn our attention to Rio. Before we even get to the LGBT angle of all of this, I feel like there's some sense before each Olympics, there's some sort of, you know, vibe out there of, oh, this place is not ready. They're not ready. You know, stuff isn't done. They're not ready. That said, I will say, Charlie, it does feel like, to the casual observer that I am listening to, you know, NPR, it does feel like, wow, this is on a different level of perhaps not being ready. Yep. Is that your impression as well?
Yeah, yeah, it definitely is my impression, and I don't want to, I'm going to be very positive about the Olympics interview because I'm such an Olympic fan.
Yeah.
I don't want to undermine the concerns that are going on because I think it's an important thing for us to talk about, especially as it comes down to things like the IOC, you know, choosing cities, what their criteria is and what it will be in the future. And I think for that reason, it's really important for us to think about this as well as the safety of the athletes and the spectators going. So there are some really big things happening over there that are scary. I would say I probably am more scared about these games than I ever have been before, and this is my eighth Olympics. So as far as the preparedness, I know that they're going to go on. I know that they're going to take place. I know that they're going to be spectacular. I think I would equate it from my experience to Athens, where I remember going to some of the swimming prelim events, and they were literally like nailing our seat numbers into the chairs as we were sitting down. And that was almost just a little bit humorous. But with these things, yeah, it seems like it's kind of hitting them on every level, from the health scare to the security issues to the downfall of some of the people in their government. It's just, it's been one thing after another. And I really do feel bad for Rio. I've been there many times before. It's a wonderful city. It's a very welcoming city. It's a very gay-friendly city. And I think some of these things happening are just really poor timing for them. And also the fact that they are running on a very shoestring budget. I've seen some of the numbers for what these Olympics are costing, and it's insane to me that they are expected to produce this type of huge world spectacle with very limited existing infrastructure. I think they knew it was going to be a challenge from the beginning, and it became more and more so as some of these other things came into play. So I have a lot of sympathy. I know a lot of the people that have been on the ground over there for 7 whole years, and you know, I felt their pain.
Yeah,
it's been crazy, but I also felt their passion, and I know that they will stop at nothing to make security and safety a big priority as much as they possibly can for people going over. So for that reason, I am not personally scared at this stage.
Good. Good. Well, the narrative that we have to put out there straight away, the important part of all of this, we're seeing so many more out athletes, are we not?
Yes, it's huge. Yes. I think the number is up to something like 35 or 36 that have come out and told us about their stories. Yeah, it's this stage, which is great. I think we're about 30 to 40% higher than the last Olympics and 50% more than the one before that. So we're headed in the right direction. It's still a disproportionate number when you think of the overall number of athletes. 30 out of 14,000 doesn't seem quite right, but we're at least headed on the right track, even if it's a slow-moving trend, yes.
Oh, very exciting. Again, listeners, we are here with Charlie Walters talking about all things Olympics. For those who haven't heard about it, tell everybody about the Pride House in Rio.
Yeah, so the Pride House is a wonderful concept that was actually started back in 2010 by a guy named Dean Nelson, who ran the Whistler Gay Ski Week. He came up with the concept, you know, there's all these, at every Olympics, there's a celebration zone for every country. I don't know if people realize that, that haven't been to an Olympics, but for example, like the Holland athletes will take over usually they have one of the biggest houses. They call it the Heineken Holland House. It's sponsored by Heineken. And they just take over kind of either a bar or, you know, some sort of existing place that they make their home base. So when the athletes medal can from those countries, they go there afterwards to celebrate and to party. So in 2010, Dean had this idea, why don't we make an LGBT house and call it the Pride House? And he got kind of the sanction from the official Vancouver organizing committee to do that, which was a big deal. And they set up a place in Whistler, which was a safe haven and also just a celebratory zone for LGBT athletes and spectators. And that was huge. I remember being there. I covered the opening of that that house, and I cried because it was just like a big deal for me to see, you know, something that I was very passionate about come together with my lifestyle. And it was really exciting. Sadly, since then, for a variety of reasons, we haven't had another Pride House. We didn't have one in London because the people organizing just had budget cuts. So the sponsors fell through. And then obviously in Sochi, for obvious reasons, that wasn't something that was allowed to occur. So in Rio, which is a very generally gay-friendly city, although we can get into some of the recent news, but I think it's a perfect place to bring back the Pride House. And there's been a wonderful organization called CDG Brazil that has been working on this for several years now. They're quite grassroots. They're not as funded as they should be, but they've made some amazing efforts to get something off the ground. So there will be actually two different sites for the Pride House, one right on the beach in a pavilion that they've set up, and then one taking over for more nighttime venues, one of the local bars in the Ipanema area. And yeah, I can't wait to get there and see it. I haven't seen the locations or anything yet, but I'm excited to get there about a week in advance and help the Pride House to bring some athletes and also some media there. I want to tape a lot of our interviews there, as many as we can. Just to give them some visibility, because I think it's really important for that to become a long-standing tradition, I hope, for every Olympics to come.
Why don't we take a step back for a second, Charlie, for our listeners who are wondering, well, but why is it important that there even be out athletes at the Olympics? How do you respond to that?
Well, it's important because they exist and they have just as great stories to tell, you know, as any of the other athletes. Do you have to include your sexuality in part of your story to succeed as an athlete? Absolutely not. But if you are, and you know, a lot of these, if you look at the other athletes and how they, every athlete really, and how they tell their story, it comes a lot, you know, about their personality and their lifestyle, and things come out in those biographies. And I think for LGBT athletes, they shouldn't be afraid to tell that story. Now, that being said, I think we're a little bit behind in history from some of the other, you know, major areas of LGBT equality. It seems like this sports equality is kind of like our last big closet that we have to break out of. And we've seen some great strides in the past few years. We've seen, you know, professional athletes come out in almost all of the major pro sporting disciplines just in the past few years, which has been really exciting. Olympics, it's a little bit of a different story. I mean, there's so much politics that goes along with it. It's governed by a huge international organization that I think has some catching up to do, and I think has made some big strides in this area to make athletes feel included and welcome. But there still are, specifically in some sporting disciplines and some that you wouldn't expect, there is a degree of homophobia that exists. And I think by athletes coming out and being visible, that's the only way we're going to break down those barriers. Because otherwise, if everybody chooses to stay in the closet, what about the young athletes who are very openly gay and want to compete in the games? If they don't have, you know, a fair road to follow and role models to follow, I think it would be horrible that we might not even see them ever succeed. So that's the reason I feel like it's important.
Yeah. Well, tell us about some of those role models. Who should we be looking out for? We know that one of the most fun things about the Olympics is that the stories are just incredible. Everybody has overcome something. I mean, we've all overcome something, but some of the stories that they feature, it doesn't even matter if they win a medal because they're at the Olympic level. So these are just the top of the top, cream of the crop athletes. But who are some of these LGBT athletes that have just the incredible stories that we should be looking out for when we all watch the Olympics?
Yeah, well, I think we should be supporting and looking out for the athletes that have already received a lot of exposure. So Tom Daley is certainly one of them. He is the diver from the UK who is a pretty big celebrity in his own right over there, and has chosen to come out between his last Olympics and this one. So he was the silver medalist in London and will now be going for the gold against our defending gold medalist, David Budaya. And I think that's going to be, as much as we're cheering for Team USA, I'm equally cheering for Tom as somebody who's made this decision. And I think somebody who has a really strong voice, certainly in Europe, but I think also over the world to make an impact for LGBT athletes. So I think we should definitely support him. But I also think we should support a lot of the athletes who don't have quite the platform to speak. So there's a great rower that I've been in touch with that I can't wait to meet. His name's Robbie Manson from New Zealand. We have a ton of amazing female athletes on our own U.S. teams, including on our basketball team, that I think are outspoken about their sexuality more than they ever have been before. We have a lot of people from Canada, a lot of people on their soccer team. We have a Brazilian diver named Ian Matos, who I'm excited to see him represent his own country, kind of in the way that Matthew Mitchum did for UK back in London. Tons of great stories. There's two women who are married who are competing in this Olympics. I think that's a really fun story to follow. And then there's another story which is really interesting, which is a little complicated, but Sester Semenya, who is a track and field athlete from South Africa, Sester is actually an intersex athlete, which is a little bit of a different thing, but is being kind of grouped into this category, whether she should be or not. And I think that's another story. I mean, this is an example of somebody who was born in a biological situation that she had no control over. And I think it's important that we learn to recognize and celebrate diversity in all respects. And this is another category of athlete that the IOC is just going to have to decide what to do with and to adhere policies to. I think the trans issue, which has come up this year, you know, them just adopting a new policy in January was a really big deal. I was almost surprised to see them do that, and I'm glad they did. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but the fact that transgender athletes no longer have to undergo their gender reassignment in order to compete in the games. They instead just have to test below a certain testosterone level. And I think that opens a whole new window for younger trans athletes who want to compete in their sports. I don't know that we're going to see somebody in these games, but there are some people that, you know, there's talk of that maybe have qualified and haven't necessarily revealed their trans identity yet, or all those sorts of things. So I think we could see huge stories in that area as well. Plus, I'd like to cap it off by saying I predict that there is somebody that is not on this list of 35 or so athletes yet that is going to come out during these games. I'm not going to necessarily say who I think they are, because that's their responsibility, or that's their right. But I'm going to tell you, I predict that we're going to see a really major coming out story during these Olympics.
Wow. That was very titillating there.
Yeah.
Okay. Where can all of our listeners go to see the work that you will be doing there at the Olympics?
Yeah, I think the best way is to follow me through social media, because I'm going to be posting everything on a wide variety of platforms. So my Facebook is Charlie with an EY, Cullen Walters. My Instagram and Twitter handle are both Olympic Chaz. That's Olympic, then C-H-A-Z. I'm going to be filming some great content for Bravo. I've been part of their family for a couple years now, and going to be doing some stuff for Andy Cohen and his show for Watch What Happens Live. So you can watch that during the games on Bravo, and also on their website, bravotv.com. And then, yeah, a lot of other cool surprise things that I can't necessarily talk about yet, but some stuff involving celebrities from Hollywood doing cool shout-outs for the athletes and taping their reactions. That's something we did in both London and Sochi, and those will be revealed via a wide variety of different outlets.
Awesome. Well, can we talk really quickly about some Charlie Walters ephemera, some other things that you have done in your life? I will tell you, sir,
sure,
that you have had one of my dream jobs. You've had one of my dream jobs. I've had many dream jobs over the years, but, and it might not be one of the ones that you're thinking about, I always wanted to work for Pilata Teamworks.
Oh, really? Interesting. Okay, no, that wouldn't have been what
I know.
But that's so interesting. Cool. Yeah, that was my first job out of college. I actually participated in then it was called the California AIDS Ride. Now it's evolved into the Life Cycle Ride. But I did that my senior year in school. I was a senior at Northwestern, and I had done something called Alternative Spring Break, where we got to go do some work over spring break. Instead of going on a party spring break, we went and volunteered for the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and that's how I found out about this event and that it was their number one fundraiser. So I signed up for it, and I rode my bike all the way from San Francisco to Los Angeles, which was not an easy thing to do, but it was with 3,000 other people that all came from different walks of life. In a way, it was almost like a mini Olympics looking back on it, because it was people who were all there for different reasons and different backgrounds, but they were all there to achieve the same thing, which was to raise as much money and awareness as they could for HIV/AIDS. I decided to work for them. I got offered a job while I was on that ride. That company moved me to California, and I worked with them until they sadly went out of business. But then the charities actually took on the event and have now, you know, made it even better in terms of the amount of proceeds they're allowed to give back to the charities. And I've ridden in that event 7 more times since then, not every single year, but every other year or so. It's an incredible event, and I encourage everybody to check it out and get involved with it.
My listeners have heard me say this a million times over. It is my favorite 7 days of the year is going out to California and working.
Are you a rider?
I am not a rider. I've never ridden it. I work every year, okay, the gear and tent crew.
You're a roadie. Yay, roadie. Awesome. That's so cool. I've always actually wanted to do that too. I've only ridden the ride, but a couple of times I have signed up, and things have come up that I haven't been able to roadie. But I've always, my dream on the ride is I've always wanted to be a part of Pit Stop 4, and you'll know what that means.
I do.
They're so much fun, and I would, love to do that. Greg Sirota, who runs that event, has become a good friend of mine and actually lived in my house, rented a room in my house for a while recently, and so I just admire him and all that he's brought to that event. He used to run Pit Stop 4, so yeah.
I will just say there's not enough time in the week for me to go to the gym as much as you would need to go to work on Pit Stop 4. Just putting that out there. Just saying that. No, I will say my first ever event and my introduction to so much of the activism that I do was one of Pilata's last events. They used to do a 3-day walk, which nobody even remembers, and it was my first ever event. Yep, it was the 3-day AIDS walk, and I did that in New York City, and it really introduced me to this idea of like, oh my gosh, there is a way that you can surround yourself with love and support and people who are all working towards the same cause, and so it's a really beautiful thing. No, that was
the phrase we used to use is a community of kindness, and that's really, really what it was. Yeah, we could do a whole show just about this. But
there you go.
Inspired by those women as well, and I remember, one of the last 3-day walks I worked was one in New York that was right after September 11th. It was such crazy timing, and that event took on a whole different world for us. We were doing it for a huge variety of reasons, but I think that's one of the reasons I love the Olympics too, is just having come from that professional background and my first job of being constantly surrounded by these really, really inspiring people. I'm reminded of that when I'm there at the games.
And this is what a small world it is, Charlie, because that walk right after 9/11, that's the event. That was the first one that I did.
Oh, wow. I wonder if we crossed paths. I was in those trailers. Remember, they had the marketing trailers, and we were signing people up for the future events.
Yeah.
And I think we did record numbers at that one of getting people on board. Yeah.
But amazing
stuff. It ended up being one of the last ones. We didn't know it was going to be, but it did. Yeah.
Amazing. All right, well, tell our listeners one more time, what is the social media information that we should be typing into our computer to follow all the incredible work that you are going to be doing at the Olympics?
Mostly it's Olympic Chaz, Olympic Chaz for Instagram and Twitter, and then Facebook, Charlie Cullen Walters. And just if you Google that, I hope my stuff will come up. And if you want to look at some of my past stuff, youtube.com/user/ET Olympics, all of our segments from Entertainment Tonight, from Sochi and London are available on there. This year I'm going to be working more with NBC, which is great because they're the rights-holding organization, and can't wait. Yeah, please follow and send your feedback, and if you have ideas or things that you want to see covered at the games that aren't being covered, let me know. If we have time, I'll be down there with a great crew, my crew, Zach and Andy, and we would love to help profile some of those stories or angles.
Amazing stuff. Well, even just hearing you talk about it, Charlie, my passion for the Olympics, which also was already pretty top-notch, it has most definitely increased. I also want to remind our listeners to keep an eye out for the debut of Charlie and Ken. We will be doing our rhythmic gymnastics in the 2020 Olympics, and that will be a sight to see.
Oh my gosh. I immediately think of that Martin Short sketch from SNL.
Exactly.
It's going to be something just like that. Cool, Ken. Well, thanks so much. Hopefully, maybe we can talk while I'm in Rio. We should set one of these up live from the games.
That would be amazing. Charlie, be safe out there, and of course, have just the most amazing time.
Thank you, Ken. You're the best. Talk to you soon.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, so much time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news out there. You guys are so adorable. A few of you wrote in and asked, well, how did it go at the RNC here in Cleveland? As I said on last week's episode, I did indeed go downtown here in Cleveland to go check out the Republican National Convention, despite my mother's objections. There were a lot of people who were very nervous, including my mother. And I think my father, through my mother, she's the one that told me that he was nervous as well, about me going downtown and checking out Cleveland, checking out the Republican National Convention. A lot of angst. People wanted me to leave the city. It's going to be crazy. There's going to be rioting. There's going to be looting. And no such thing happens. In fact, there was a great piece in, I think it was Fortune magazine, stated that the one thing that everybody agreed upon here at the RNC was that Cleveland was the star, that Cleveland just was so walkable and accessible, and everybody was so friendly. So kudos to Cleveland, who hosted a great RNC, in that we hosted a conference successful and not that the RNC was great. So yeah, I went downtown with a couple friends of mine, and it was pretty nutty. It was the fourth day. It was last Thursday. So it was the fourth day of the convention. It was so hot outside. So I think people at this point were pretty done. You know, the media had been there for about 3-4 weeks at that point, and even the protesters who had been there, this was their fourth day. It was really hot. I think people were really tired. I didn't really see any huge, huge protests. At one point, it was this very kind of young liberal arts protest. It was the communists versus the socialists versus the anarchists, and the police were kind of like, I guess we need to surround them. I didn't have that many uncomfortable interactions. I was standing behind the MSNBC booth on East 4th. East 4th is this amazing cobblestone street here in Cleveland. It's right downtown. It's all restaurants and I think a comedy club and this amazing bar, shout out Society, the name of the bar Society. They should become a sponsor for as much as I'm there. This kind of 1920s basement speakeasy. Very cool place. Anyway, so East 4th is a closed-off street. It's a pedestrian walkway street, and that's where a lot of the media were. And so the MSNBC booth was set up there, and right in front of me was Andrea Mitchell, who was interviewing Al Franken. Right in front of me, it was just a few feet away. And some guy who was holding some sort of religious Bible verse sign turned to me and said, you know, God's going to judge you. And I said, well, actually, I'm Jewish. And then I looked at his shirt, and his shirt had one of those don't signs, you know, the circle with the slash through it. And in the circle with the slash through it was the word homo. So I said, you know, I'm Jewish. And then I looked at his shirt and said, also, I'm gay. And he said, oh, well, then God's going to really judge you. And I don't know, in that moment, I just said, great, then you don't have to. You have a lot of free time now, sir. You could take a pottery class. He didn't like that. That was really it for me in uncomfortable interactions. I didn't get upset. There's no reason to get upset at interactions like that. Unless you're somehow standing there and this guy is triggering an epiphany in you and you're thinking, oh my gosh, God really is going to judge me. But even so, there's no reason to get upset with this guy. Not at all. That only validates his feelings. I had a couple interactions with gay Republicans as well, but mostly I was interacting with gay Republicans online, and I just can't stop interacting with gay Republicans online. And so that prompted me, you can go check out, in the Huffington Post this week, just released a few days ago, I wrote a piece called How to Not Lose Your Mind Interacting with Gay Republicans. And it's not a joke. I really mean this. I talked about, so last week I was on the CLE cast, and that's a local podcast here in Cleveland, and I talked all about my addiction, and it really is an addiction. I am not making a joke right now. I am addicted to interacting with gay Republicans online. I do it all the time. I lose time. My poor partner, I remember walking down the street at one point, I think 2 weeks ago, and I just couldn't stop on Twitter, and he just said, are we going to be spending time together? I lose time to it. It's a real addiction. I think that I can craft some sort of perfect message that's going to make a gay Republican stop in their tracks and say, oh, I never thought about it that way, and it just doesn't work that way. So I took all the things that I've learned, I put them in a piece called How to Not Lose Your Mind Interacting with Gay Republicans. I will link to it. Here's just some of the things that I want to share with you all, some of the things that I've learned. Number one, do not try to change gay Republicans, folks. Don't try to change them. They're not morons. I know that we want to believe that they're self-hating, self-interested, confused props for a party that betrays them with every vote that they take, and I wrote that in the piece. And there are times that I very much do believe that. But they know who they are, and so trying to change them, I don't know that that's ever worked, where someone has interacted with a gay Republican, particularly online, and had some great point, and the gay Republican has said, oh my gosh, I am now a Democrat. It doesn't work like that. Another piece of advice, you have to come prepared. I have learned that gay Republicans have their facts, stats, and figures all lined up. They know their stuff, and you need to be prepared. I've learned that you should not try to represent the entire LGBTQ community. When I have said things like, well, the gay community thinks that, well, that's just not true, because these gay Republicans, they don't feel included by that. Not at all. I recommend that you speak from the I. So don't speak for the whole community, but tell your story. I think it is the most effective strategy, not even just with dealing with gay Republicans, but dealing with actual people, is tell your own story. Say, this is what I experienced. It makes people stop in their tracks. I highlighted this in the article, and again, go check it out. We have to keep talking about issues of race. That's fine. You want to ally yourself with the Republican Party, some gay people, then you need to also acknowledge that the Republican Party, and this is a stat that you all need to know, you need to shout this statistic. If you only learn one statistic from me today, it is this one, and you need to tell everyone who listens. So everyone who says the Republican Party is inclusive, really, because out of 2,472 delegates here in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention, 2,472 delegates, 18 of them were black. 18 out of 2,472. That would be less than 1%. It's less than 0.75%. This is not the party of equality. And as I wrote in this piece for the Huffington Post, our fight for equality, the LGBTQ fight for equality, is interwoven with that of our brothers and sisters of color. And we have to know these stats. So really do highlight issues of race. And my final point is, don't give up. Keep having these interactions. I think it's important to have these interactions. If we don't have these interactions, then gay Republicans, who are going to get more and more exposure. I mean, that's what we saw at the RNC here in Cleveland. Peter Thiel, there on the last night, and that's the coveted night that you want to speak. It's not to say that the other nights are not great. President Obama speaking at night 3 of the Democratic National Convention. Incredible. Incredible. Michelle Obama, night 1. Incredible. But if you're a random person like Peter Thiel, the night you want to get on is the fourth night, because that's the big night. That's the night that the candidate accepts their nomination and all eyes are there. And Peter Thiel got up there, and what he was supposed to do, what a lot of reports said was going to happen, was that Peter Thiel was going to get up to the microphone and really take Republicans to task and disagree with them. And that's not really what happened. He got up there and said, I'm proud to be gay. I'm proud to be a Republican. I'm proud to be American. He made some sort of shout out to, we don't always agree here in the Republican Party, but that was pretty much it. And what you saw online from the gay Republicans and the gay conservatives was complete and utter validation. Here we go, night 4 of the RNC, and Peter Thiel is up there validating us. And so they are going to have the microphone, more and more gay Republicans. They're going to have it. So we can't just disengage from these conversations. And since I put up this piece, a lot of people responded, I just choose to ignore the gay Republicans. I think that we do so at our own peril. I think that if they are allowed to spew some of the intolerance that gay Republicans are spewing, and they are not met with resistance, that's problematic. So I don't believe in disengaging. So that's my piece, how to not lose your mind interacting with gay Republicans. I know I just told you a lot of what's happening there in that piece, but still, go check it out. Go check it out. A couple other things that have happened here on the political front in Philadelphia. A lot of conservatives, this is from The Advocate, they are losing their minds over the Democratic National Convention's gender-neutral bathrooms. Apparently, it is just too much for some people to handle. Too much for the conservatives to handle. Tucker Carlson from Fox News, he thinks that gender-neutral bathrooms are disgusting. That is a quote. Disgusting. This week, the Fox News host took aim at the all-gender facilities unveiled at the Democratic National Convention. And there in Philadelphia, the DNC installed two such restrooms at the venue. Just only two. That's it. So Tucker Carlson, who has referred to affirming bathroom access for trans people as, quote, frivolous, he claimed that the facilities are just one of many bizarre features of the DNC. He asked his co-hosts on Fox and Friends, which I've tried to watch. That one is, I think, the most hateful of all the Fox shows. They are so smarmy and snarky. I'm just saying, it's not a good one. He, there on Fox and Friends, said this quote, I mean, I guess we're liberated by this. Everyone should come visit one and see the reality of it. It's unbelievable. I mean, the whole thing was like an alternate reality, end quote. He could just not wrap his mind around it. He wasn't the only one who was bothered by transgender inclusion. Former presidential candidate Mike Huckabee claimed that the addition of these bathrooms showed that Democrats had lost touch with the concerns of the average American. He tweeted this quote, with so many distractions, it's nice to know the DNC kept their focus on what's truly important. Jason Rantz, a conservative radio show host who broadcasts out of Seattle, he argued that the restrooms are nothing but a publicity stunt. Again, the obsession with the conservatives with these bathrooms. He wrote this quote, all of the other bathrooms in the arena appear to be more traditional, split by the sexes. Is it a coincidence that the all-gender restroom is right by the press booth? Yes, sir. It probably is. He also pointed out that the bathrooms were not a permanent addition to the arena. Instead, just a women's bathroom with a new sign on it. Yeah. Yeah. That means that the DNC is trying to prove a point that you can do this. It's actually not that difficult. Not that difficult. And it is a big issue, and it continues to be a big issue. North Carolina, we've seen now that the NBA All-Star Game has now been pulled from North Carolina. Well, that's going to have quite the effect on the economy there. They were counting on some of that money. One last thing about the DNC. Night 4 of the DNC is going to focus on so many different issues, but it will also have a first. A first. The Human Rights Campaign announced that the HRC Foundation National Press Secretary, Sarah McBride, she's going to speak on night 4 of the DNC. This marks the first time in history that an openly transgender person will speak at a major party convention. Amazing. The first time in history an openly transgender person will speak at a major party convention. Now, Chad Griffin is also speaking. He will also be speaking there at the DNC on that evening. I know a lot of people have a lot of issues with Chad Griffin, so we will see what he says. Not sure how I feel about Chad Griffin. Kind of irks me a little bit, but he's a huge Clinton supporter. So that's everything that's going on from the political front, but that is not the only stuff going on in the world. Other things happening as well. A court has ruled that a Christian law school cannot be denied accreditation based on its exclusionary sex policies. Trinity Western University, a Canadian Christian university with about 3,500 students, they had first announced plans to open a law school in 2016. The school requires all students to sign a pledge to abstain from, quote, sexual intimacy that violates the sacredness of marriage between a man and a woman, which effectively bans gay students. Due to the policy, the Nova Scotia Barrister Society decided at the time to refuse accreditation to their law school, which is a decision that led to a prolonged legal battle when the university claimed their religious liberty had been infringed. But the Court of Appeal this week upheld a ruling against the Barrister Society, finding that they cannot be blocked. The ruling says, quote, nothing in the Legal Profession Act authorizes the society to issue an independent ruling that someone has violated Nova Scotia's Human Rights Act. We would dismiss the appeal. The society and the respondents agree that substantial costs were incurred in the appeal. The preparation undertaken by the parties and interveners was evident from the volume of materials before the court, blah, blah, blah. There's more and more. The society then had to pay $35,000, and this might go on. It might go on. Bruce Clemenger of Canada's Evangelical Fellowship, who helped represent the university in the case. He celebrated the ruling. He said this, quote, "This decision is a good reminder that TWU, that's the university, the university's policies and its community covenant are not unlawful. They are an expression of their deeply held religious beliefs. Religious institutions have made significant contributions to the public good in Canada and make up an important part of the Canadian mosaic. A critical component of living in a free, diverse, and plural society is the affirmation of religious freedom and the recognition of the contribution of faith-based organizations make to our society." So, here's the deal. I am not, obviously, for any academic institution that restricts students' sexual orientation in any conceivable way, but this is a private university. And that's not how accreditation works. You can't just swoop in and say, well, we don't like their policy here with this private university. If it's a public university, that's a whole different ballgame. But with a private university, no, of course they can make a policy like this. Do I support the policy? Absolutely not. And what I least support, or one could say what I am against more than anything, is an academic institution saying to gay students, you need to choose. You need to choose between your faith and your sexual orientation. As we talked about on last week's show and a ton of different shows with Reverend Irene Monroe on last week's show and with so many other guests on shows previously over the past 8 years, that is a false choice. Asking students to make that choice, that's not right. That's not the way it should work in our society. Students should be able to espouse their faith and their sexual orientation. But when it comes down to accreditation, as an individual who is a college professor who actually studies these things in higher education, that's who I am, folks. I do have a day job. Yeah, they can do that. They can do that. But I would implore academic institutions, allow students to be who they are. Do not present to them this very false choice between faith and sexual orientation. That's not the way students develop. So, I know I referenced very briefly what happened in North Carolina, but there are some players in the story that you should know about. An out gay NBA executive helped to influence the decision to move the 2017 All-Star Game away from North Carolina in protest against the state's anti-LGBT law. The NBA announced last week that it had opted to move this All-Star Game from Charlotte, North Carolina. This is in protest against the state's anti-LGBT HB2, which was introduced this year. The league had previously said that they were deeply concerned by HB2, which rolled back pre-existing LGBT rights protections. But it has emerged that out gay Golden State Warriors president Rick Welts, he influenced the decision at an NBA board meeting at which he said he would not be comfortable at the All-Star Game if it were in Charlotte. USA Today reported that Welts' words weren't emotional, but that he simply said he would not attend if the game were to take place in North Carolina. By the way, this is exactly what I'm saying about telling your story. Say how these things affect you. This is what out gay Golden State Warriors president Rick Welts did. Now, we can go into these board meetings and say, well, here's how it's going to affect the economy. This is how many people might not buy tickets if it's in North Carolina. But one of the things that very much affected the pulling of the All-Star Game from North Carolina was one individual saying, hey, I wouldn't go. I will not attend if it takes place there. I am telling my truth. I'm not telling you how to think. I'm just telling my truth. And that affected things. Incredible. Incredible stuff. Pop culture news. We don't do nearly enough pop culture news. Kristen Stewart, star of Twilight, big star, she has said that she is happier after going public about her sexuality. I love it. The Twilight actress, who was for many years linked to her co-star Robert Pattinson, she came out earlier this year, I don't even know that we covered that, after allowing herself to be photographed with her girlfriend. It was unclear at the time whether Kristen Stewart actually was out of the closet, but responding to a question about her sexuality last year, she alluded to the rumors by saying, "Google me, I'm not hiding." Well, in an interview with Elle UK magazine this week, Stewart directly acknowledged that she was dating girls for the first time. She said, quote, "When I was dating a guy, I was hiding everything that I did because everything personal felt like it was immediately trivialized, so I didn't like it. We were turned into these characters and placed into this ridiculous comic book, And I was like, that's mine. You're making my relationship something that it's not. I didn't like that. But then it changed when I started dating a girl. I was like, actually, to hide this proves the implication that I'm not down with it or I'm ashamed of it. So I had to alter how I approached being in public. It opened my life up and I'm so much happier. I love this. Now you're thinking, what the heck does this matter? This is a random actress. And she's not a random actress. She's a huge actress. Twilight was a very big deal with a whole generation of our population. She's in the new Woody Allen movie. Anytime people are out and open about their lives, when they are in a position to do so, when it is safe to do so. By the way, I'm okay with people being in the closet if it's not safe for them to come out. I am not a supporter. I've said this many times on the show over the past 8 years. I am not a supporter of come out wherever you are. Because for some individuals, particularly if they are financially dependent on other people who might cut them off if they come out, I don't support the coming out. Hollywood celebrities, that's a tough one for me. Because as in the case of Kristen Stewart, they can do such good by being out and open in their lives. But some of them, they're not willing to make that choice. That's okay as long as they are not doing blatantly homophobic things. As long as they are not throwing the gays under the bus. There are a couple Hollywood celebrities who are widely known to be gay who kind of throw the gays under the bus. And that's not so cool. So that I don't support. But Kristen Stewart saying that being with her girlfriend, being out about it, quote, it opened my life up and I'm so much happier. That makes a difference. That makes a difference. It really does. So kudos to Kristen Stewart. Turning our attention to Mississippi, a hardline Christian group that battled to keep state sodomy laws, they helped draft Mississippi's controversial religious freedom law. Now, who is saying that? Is that the group saying that and other people can deny it? No, that would be the governor of the state of Mississippi. He has now admitted that. The governor of Mississippi, Phil Bryant, signed a new law in April that enables discrimination against LGBT people, ignoring pleas from business leaders in the state. The law goes even further than most, even permitting people to discriminate based on sexual orientation in any employment-related decision and any decision concerning the sale, rental, or occupancy of a dwelling. As long as it's based on, I feel like if I had a live show, this is where you all would say, sincerely held religious beliefs. That's the phrase. That's when the duck drops from the ceiling holding a card that says, sincerely held religious beliefs. Or in the case of Mississippi, it's sincerely held religious beliefs or moral convictions. What does that mean? Nobody knows. There is no litmus test for sincerely held religious beliefs or moral convictions. So because there's no litmus test, anybody can say it, which means that discrimination in Mississippi is actually allowed in any employment-related decision and any decision concerning the sale, rental, or occupancy of a dwelling. But in a shocking, if unsurprising, revelation this week, Governor Bryant has admitted that the law was mostly drafted. It was mostly drafted by hardline anti-LGBT group Alliance Defending Freedom. Which, by the way, there's some irony in that name because that's not what they're actually doing. The notorious Christian group Alliance Defending Freedom, they've opposed same-sex weddings, gay adoption, civil unions, and even the repeal of sodomy laws, strongly opposing the 2003 Supreme Court decision to strike down state laws banning gay sex. Though other U.S.-based groups have moved away from the overt anti-sodomy agenda, not the Alliance Defending Freedom, they continue to peddle their wares overseas. They're in Belize right now trying to keep gay sex illegal. This is what they're spending time and money on. Governor Bryant admitted the group's involvement. He described their involvement as perfectly normal. He said, quote, we appreciate the Alliance Defending Freedom working with the legislature to draft House Bill 1523. It is perfectly normal for our office to work with individuals and organizations who have had a role in requesting and or opposing legislation during the bill review process to gather additional information. He even went further. It's not just that they worked on the legislation and he sought their counsel, so much more than that. The group even helped Governor Bryant write the speech he gave upon signing the law. Jeez. Unbelievable. This comes after emails obtained by attorney Robbie Kaplan, who is suing over the state's law, exposing that the ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, has been responsible for providing model laws that form the substance of what was passed in HB 1523. I'm so sorry to our brothers and sisters there in Mississippi. We know this is not the only thing going on in your state. We know that there are people fighting for freedom. Again, same thing going on in North Carolina. I hate any impression that your state is being characterized by this very small group of people, but it's a small group of people with power, right? They're able to pass these laws. They have power. We know that they do not represent your entire state. We know that. You're doing great work there. But it's even more important that all of us use our voices. And by the way, that applies to you all who are in the states where you have these protections. I'm looking at you, Vermont. I'm looking at you, New England. This is where it is critically important, if you are in a state, that you have these protections, that you not sit back and rest on your laurels. You have to reach out to Mississippi and lend support there. You have to reach out to North Carolina and lend your support there. There is so much work to be done, and we cannot exist in our silos. That's not the way it works here. When some of us are not free, all of us are not free. It doesn't work the other direction when it comes to equality. It doesn't work that because you have these protections in Vermont, that all of us have these protections. That's obviously not the case. And so I'm picking on Vermont because I lived there for 6 years. If you are sitting there in Vermont, if you're sitting there in New England, if you're sitting there in a place where these protections are afforded to you, you cannot fully rejoice because there are brothers and sisters in other states, Mississippi, North Carolina, so many others, where these protections do not exist. Reach out and support these organizations. Even if it means, look, at the very minimum, if you're on social media, find the LGBT statewide organization in these states, in Mississippi and North Carolina, and like their page, subscribe to their feeds, and share their articles. Raise awareness. Raising awareness does a great, great thing. It helps people tell their stories. That's what Kristen Stewart is doing. That's what's happening in the NBA when one person said, no, I would not go to North Carolina. It's individuals using their voices that then bolster other people. We're seeing it at the Democratic National Convention. We will see it on day four. We're recording this on day four. When you guys hear it, it's probably past day four. You gotta use your voice. That is the message for this week's episode of This Show Is So Gay, episode number 364. That is also the message of episodes number 1 through 363. Get out there. Go use your voice to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. Use your voice to make a difference. But remember, while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Some dreams.